This is a Dreamcast disc and is for use only on a Dreamcast unit. Playing this disc on a hi-fi or other audio equipment can cause serious damage to its speakers.
Dreamcast, up to 6 billion players.
Welcome back to the stage of history.
Why don't we play together?
Hey, it's time to make some crazy money. Are you ready? Here we go!
Please stop this disc now.
Hello and welcome to episode 12 of the Dreamcast Junkyard Dream Pod. My name is Tom, and today I'm joined by three of the most unprofessional, rude people in the Dreamcast community, but they know their stuff when it comes to the Dreamcast. So, without further ado, I'm joined by Gaz.
Hello.
You all right? Did you like that intro?
It was lovely, yeah. Well, unprofessional. Oh, yeah, okay. I'll go along with that.
And also, Rob.
Oi, oi!
You perked up, Rob.
Why, me old China?
I understand you had a barbecue last night. How did that go?
It was superb, and the best thing about it is that I've got a lot of leftover alcohol, some of which I'm drinking right now.
Oh, nice.
I hope everyone listening out there in Dreamcast Land is also raising a glass as they listen to this episode 12 of the Dream Pod. Last but not least, joining us from upstate New York, I love saying that, it's Caleb.
Hello, Tosh. I hope you're doing well today.
Yeah, I'm great, thanks. You sound like you've got a bit of a sore throat there, Caleb. Are you okay?
I was sick this week.
Oh, okay.
The doctor told me I had to rest, but I heard the fans of the Dreamcast podcast Dream Pod had questions, so I'm gonna be here to answer them.
It's funny when you're ill, you sound a little bit like your friend Jesse Ventura. Has he been around?
Oh, do I? Well, you know, I've been hanging out with him a lot, so maybe that's why, you know.
He's rubbed off on you a little bit.
Maybe.
I ain't got time to bleed.
Cool. Okay, thanks again, as usual, guys, for joining me on this lovely summer's day. It might not be lovely where you are listening to this now, because, you know, the weather is quite changeable. But as we always do, we'll just briefly chat about what we've been playing or bought in the last week or so, last couple of weeks. I'll go first. What have I been playing? I've been playing a little bit of Daytona USA on the Dreamcast on the VJ monitor. I always thought that it looked a bit fuzzy on TV, even like with RGB. And since getting my VGA PC monitor and everything hooked up, I've been going through the library to see how good certain games look. I know not all of them work on it, as we discussed in the last episode. But by God, Daytona 2001 looks amazing through the VGA connection. So I've been playing that. And I have to be honest, I've not actually been buying a lot of stuff. I've not bought anything for the Dreamcast since the last episode. And the only thing I have got is King of Fighters 95 for the Sega Saturn with the RAM expansion cart as well.
I saw that. Yeah, you got that for a damn good price as well.
Yeah, it was only £10, so nobody else bid on it. So I was quite surprised
to have
actually won it.
That's great, because the RAM cart goes for about 20 quid on its own, doesn't it?
Does it really?
Yeah, is that the memory RAM expansion thing you got?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure whether or not the one that comes with King of Fighters 95 in the little box is actually just for King of Fighters 95, or whether it can be used for other games on a Saturn.
I have no idea. But then the memory cart is the RAM expansion. I'm sure it goes for it was a 20 quid on it anyway, but
yeah,
hey ho, fair play.
But as you'd expect, it's a great version of the King of Fighters, one of the earlier ones. And I'm not, like, again, I've got a lot of them on the Sega Dreamcast, but not on the not on anything else. And yeah, it's just as good as the other ones, really. I'll throw the floor open to you guys. I mean, Rob, what have you been doing?
I'm afraid I've still not really, I've not done much on the Dreamcast again this week because I'm still on my sort of Saturn kick at the moment. So there's been more Castlevania X, and I've been playing more of Metal Black, which I think I mentioned before, which is a good shooter, and also Layer Section.
Oh, yeah.
It's really common. There's like nothing special about it. It's just sort of like a run-of-the-mill vertical scrolling shoot 'em up. But I don't know. I really like the aesthetic of it. It's like there's nothing that I would say, oh yes, you've got to play Layer Section for this specific reason. Do you know what I mean? Nothing really stands out about it, but just the whole package is really tight. So I've been having fun with those.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid Yeah, nothing on Dreamcast. I'm letting the side down.
I drank some Adirondack seltzer. You know, it's just the secret that we have here in upstate New York is the Adirondack seltzer.
Okay.
So I feel temporarily revived, and I have to say that I actually own multiple copies of Layer Slick, and it's actually called Galactic Attack is the U.S. release is called that.
Oh, cool.
It didn't get a PAL release, did it, Layer Section?
I don't recognize it as a...
It didn't get a PAL release. No, I'm pretty sure.
Well, we'll have to see what my friend Wikipedia says about that.
No, the game doesn't ring a bell as a PAL release.
It's saying it was released in Europe as Galactic Attack as well.
Oh wow! I didn't even realize. I've never heard the term Galactic Attack.
It's okay. This is one of those games. I literally own three copies of this game. So I own it as Rayforce, and I own it as Layer Selection, and I owe it as Galactic Attack. So I own three versions of the same game, and it's also called Gunlock. Video games are so confusing.
Indeed. Anyway, was that it for you, Rob, then, yeah?
Yeah, sorry, Tom. I've let the side down.
No, not at all. No, not at all. Caleb, how about you?
Unfortunately, I was sick this week, so I wasn't able to do too much video game playing.
You didn't mention that you'd been sick.
Oh, well, you know, I have been. But I dragged myself out of bed, though, because there's going to be fan questions today, and I respect the fans.
You have a duty.
Yes. In any case... I've been selling some stuff, so I've been testing out some extra copies of stuff that I have. So I've been messing around with House of the Dead 2 and Dino Crisis and all that stuff.
Oh, I love that. I love Dino Crisis again.
Dino Crisis 2 was really great. Dino Crisis is one of those games where I need to sit down and play it. Boy, it's just you really feel helpless against dinosaurs. Not so much zombies, but dinosaurs. It seems like you're really kind of screwed if you don't, you know. If you don't plan ahead when you go into a room.
The thing is, I mean, if you are faced with a zombie attack, I mean, they are generally quite slow. I mean, you can get away from a zombie because they just kind of shamble around. And they're generally quite stupid as well. But with a dinosaur, it's actually a predator. Yeah,
if you've got a flock of velociraptor coming at you, you haven't got a chance really, have you?
Exactly, yeah. Cool. Thanks, Caleb. Gaz, what have you been doing?
All I've been playing is Far Cry 4. That's kind of taken over my life at the moment. Yeah, I mean, did you mention, didn't you, you had it on the PS4, Tom, didn't you?
I
went out and traded it in, and I'm pretty much... I mean, I love Far Cry 3, but I've finally got Far Cry 4. I've been working my way through that, and that's pretty much all I've been doing. I haven't really bought anything. I'm actually selling pretty much all of my collection anyway.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that a few weeks ago. Did you get any takers on your massive eBay?
Ah, well, it's still option. On. I've had quite a few, nothing solid as yet. But okay, I'm not in any rush to sell. The only reason I'm selling it is because I'm just sick of having games I'm not going to play, and I need space. I need the space, really.
You're not selling absolutely everything, are you? Is it just like things that you're not generally not playing on?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. I'm keeping all my Resident Evils, my Final Fantasies, my Grand Theft Auto. I'm going to concentrate on like particular series of games and then games that I will play rather than buying any old rubbish that I'll just sit on my shelf and never get played. So
with retro game collecting in general, there is the... it's too easy to basically get drawn in and just start buying everything you see with no real aim.
I know!
It was one of them. I thought, well, I see these people and I'm thinking, oh, you're buying too much. You're buying too much. You're a hoarder. And I'm looking at myself. I'm going, hang on, that's me.
Yeah.
I'm just buying some of it because it's cheap and for the sake of it.
Caleb, what were you going to say?
No, it's just I even bought a Jaguar a while back. So, you know, it's like, boy, I mean, how pathetic can you have to be?
You've gone too far there, Caleb. That's far
the 3DO,
too far.
The 3DO was one... The CDI and the 3DO was one thing, but, I mean, come on. Why do I need a Jaguar?
I'm going to put a stop to this right now. Okay. funnily enough, we will come back to the Jaguar later on, but we'll leave that for now. Gaz. Before we get on with the actual episode proper, I just wanted to quickly mention the fact that the Dream Pod has been nominated, thanks to you lot, our listeners, for a UK Podcast Award. Basically, this is a ceremony that's been held in Manchester in September. And it's basically a celebration of UK podcasters, and one of the categories is for the best video games podcast. And because of the votes that we received through the site, which is UK Podcasters, We have been sort of nominated as a finalist in the category.
Yeah,
so
we are in. Yeah,
there's ourselves, and there's the Retro Asylum podcast, which is, you know, a huge podcast. And then I think it's UK PlayStation Radio.
PlayStation, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, it's just an honour to be nominated with these guys. I mean, I'm not holding up any hope that we're going to win it because, you know, they've got thousands of fans and we have only been going for, what, 4 months? But it's just a great honour to be even mentioned and also to be a finalist. So,
listen, at the end of the day, if we're in the top three, that's an achievement in itself.
Exactly that, yeah. I mean, you people listening to this can still go to the UK podcasters website. If you just go to Google and type UK Podcast Awards 2015, you will find the site.
I'm sure there's a link on the page as well, isn't there?
Yeah, there is indeed on the main Junkyard page. Yeah, you can still have, you know, a say in the decision by voting for the finalists that you think should win the category. It's down to the judges as well as the public vote, but, you know, go on there. You know, if you like what you hear here on the Dream Pod, then please give us a vote. I will say that I first got into doing podcasting because I used to listen to Retro Asylum, and I know most of the guys who do the podcast, and the great guys. There's no animosity at all, but, you know, between a bit of friendly rivalry and banter. But
yes, but we want to crush them.
Yes. So yeah, that's the first thing I wanted to mention. Also, the other thing I wanted to mention is the fact that we are now running the third and final part of our 10th anniversary competition, where you can win one of the Dreamcast Collection vinyls, which Sega Europe kindly donated to us. And whereas the first part of the competition was asking about your memories and why you feel such a heartfelt passion for the Dreamcast, and the second part was naming the games that we listed on the page, heavily cropped images. This one is going to be a test of skill, and what we want you to do is basically take a picture of your fastest lap time on Desert Special Stage 1 with the Celica GT4. The competition is running for a month.
That's on Sega Rally 2, by the way, folks.
Sorry, I didn't mention that. Yeah, it's Sega Rally 2. So by all means, get your times in. Send us a screenshot to admin@thedreamcastjunkyard.co.uk. And whoever gets the fastest time.
No, I'm actually quite good at Sega Rally games, so I'm going to post the time and see if anyone can beat me. As a challenge for you, folks.
Yeah, I posted the time today of like 56 seconds and something, which I thought was pretty good. But then somebody said, well, I can do that in 53 seconds. I was like, well, you know, the gauntlet's been thrown down now.
Right,
then let's see your time.
53. That's a challenge, then. That's a challenge. What is it? What stage is it?
Desert Stage 1. Special Stage 1. With the Celica GT4.
The very first course.
It's the very first course, yes.
I can do that in about 50 seconds. I'm sure I can, if not a bit quicker.
Well, Gaz, put your money where your mouth is.
I will do. Don't worry. I will do.
Obviously, you can't win because you're part of the Dreamcast Junkyard staff.
No, but... just bragging rights.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, come on, folks. Get cracking.
Yeah, get cracking, indeed. Okay, so we're going to move on to the first section of the podcast today. And what I wanted to talk about was basically us here on the Dream Pod I wouldn't say we're experts as such. You know, there's always things that we don't know, but we are quite learned in the Dreamcast and its library. But people who are listening to this may not have had a Dreamcast when it was contemporary and maybe have just gotten into the system and are now collecting games for it. So we wanted to revisit some of the games that we think are, you know, the best in their genre, and maybe, you know, just have a little discussion about why it's great, you know, what's not so great, and, you know, the little things that people who have played the game extensively may know, but other people may not. And the first game we wanted to discuss in this manner is probably one of the best games on the system, and that is Metropolis Street Racer.
Well, this, we had a vote on the page recently, didn't we? And this came out tops as the best racing game. So, well, the fans voted. So,
it's going to be more of a review and discussion about the game and our opinions of it. Basically, Metropolis Street Racer came out in late 2000 in the UK and early 2001 in the US. made by Bizarre Creations, you know, who are no longer in existence, but we'll talk about that in a little bit. Weirdly, there was no Japanese release. I believe it was in development, but then was cancelled very early on, the conversion anyway. Before we go into this, the main sort of meat of this review discussion, I just wondered who here has played the game and is like kind of au fait with it.
Oh yeah, I have, yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Caleb?
Nope.
I take it you're familiar with the game. You must have heard of it.
Yes, I am familiar with the game, but I've never actually played it, and I'm not actually sure if I have it in my collection or not.
The one thing I wanted to just note before we jump in here is that according to the Wikipedia page, I did a little bit of research on the facts and figures surrounding this game. It only actually sold 120,000 units in total, which is
that's crazy,
pretty small compared to today's, you know, stats. Yeah. And get this, out of that 120,000 copies, 101,000 copies were sold in the US and only 18,000 were sold in Europe. How mental is that?
Yeah, I've always presumed that, one, it sold a hell of a lot more than that, because for me at least, I've always seen it as the most famous and like celebrated racer on the Dreamcast. But two, I've always seen it as a massive European mark, to use car lingo. Yeah. Like, thought this was a game that was played in Europe, that, you know, Europe is what made MSR what it is, and what and why it was then picked up later on the Xbox under a different name. So 120,000, that's nothing today, isn't it? You'd be considered a massive failure if you only sold 120,000 copies.
I mean, 18,000 copies in Europe, but then again, you look on eBay, it's not a rare game, is it?
No, not at all, no. I mean, according to the Wikipedia article, basically, in the opening 2 days of the game's availability, it sold 13,000 copies in Europe, or in the UK. And so the other 5,000 copies were after the first two opening days. It sold next to nothing, you know, after that, after the opening sales. I mean, obviously, the other 101,000 came from the US, and, you know, it was launched in early 2001.
But then again, if it's coming in at 2000, then it's Dreamcast sales on a whole were down at that point anyway.
Let's go back to the beginning. Metropolis Street Racer was meant to be the killer app, you know, launch title for the Dreamcast. I don't know if you guys have seen the early screens where the cars were completely different and it was more of an arcade racer. And then obviously it went away and then it came back as this kind of like more simmy racer.
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe it was the fact that it was so heavily delayed. As I say, it was meant to be a launch game and it only came out sort of really towards the end of the Dreamcast's life.
Mm.
Ignoring all the sales stuff and all that, let's just have a little look at the actual game itself. What Metropolis Street Racer is, as the name suggests, is you take part in races in a metropolitan setting, i.e. in cities. And the three cities that are featured in the game are San Francisco, London, and Tokyo. And what is interesting about Metropolis Street Racer is that the developers, Bizarre Creations, actually went around to the different cities where the game is set and took, you know, 40,000 photographs of the locations to build these accurate models of the cities. When I first started the Junkyard, I actually went to London. I went to London with a friend just for a day trip. And as part of that trip, I wanted to go to different places that are in the game and take pictures and then compare them to how they look in Metropolis Street Racer. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty accurate, I must say, certainly around, you know, around Westminster and around the Houses of Parliament. The one thing I did note, that there used to be, I don't know if it's still there anymore, but there's a Tesco right opposite the Houses of Parliament. And in the game, in Metropolis Street Racer, it's just like a boarded up shop. It's not a Tesco.
Yeah, I suppose you can't put branding in there, can they, I suppose?
No, but I would have thought it'd be a supermarket at least, but yeah, unfortunately, no, it's not.
I was going to say, I think I agree with you. I think that's one of the things for me, at least, that makes MSR a little bit special. There's a bit more attention to detail. I mean, the graphics are fabulous for a racer on the Dreamcast to start with. It is that attention to detail, like you say. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, if you compare the graph, like if you boot it up today, you say it's pretty accurate. Like, yeah, the buildings, the roughly the building locations are pretty accurate in placement, but obviously they're all still very blocky. Mm. You know, it's nothing like the open worlds. Like, you know, when they celebrate, oh, GTA 5, look how they've, you know, modeled it on real life, and these buildings are absolutely pixel perfect. You know, when you see those images come around the internet with like someone holding up a picture from the game in real life. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So you can see both the real and, mm-hmm. and fake, and they look almost the same. It's not that fidelity, obviously, because it was so long ago. But the developers, They clearly wanted to, I think what you say with when it was originally conceptualized, it wasn't meant to be quite as arcadey as this. And I think you can tell in how they approach certain things, like how they model the cities, the three cities, and like the time of day system.
Yeah.
It actually used the clock in your Dreamcast to determine what time of day it was in the three cities. So if you booted it up at like 10 o'clock in the morning in England and you raced in London, sure,
it would be all rainy.
It'd rain.
Because of the UK.
It'd be raining, but you know, if you played at the exact same time in England, but you were racing in Tokyo, it'd be nighttime. Yeah. That, for me, sort of sums up why it's a little bit special.
Just going on from that, I remember when I first played it, and I knew that it had different, you know, time of day settings and different things. But when it comes up and it says, you know, make sure your clock is correct and what is your time zone, I was just like, what's this? You know, I've never seen this in a game before.
Yeah.
It's funny, actually, I was playing it earlier on today just to refresh my memory because I've not played it for a while, and it came up, you know, are you GMT or GMT plus one? And I was thinking back to our, you know, with Caleb, because of his difference of time zones. Like, we had a bit of a conversation over email about whether or not we are GMT plus one now. I was like, wait a minute, should it be GMT plus one or should it be minus what?
No, we're always GMT.
No, we're GMT
zero.
Oh, we're not going to get into this, are we? We're GMT plus one now, aren't we? Because it's like British summertime.
We'll share some emails after this. Just call it UK time, because if I put UK time into Google, it'll give me the time every time. So, yeah.
Just continuing from a personal point of view with MSR is that I really think it's sat in the sweet spot for me personally in terms of how I like to play racing games, because it had the whole kudos system, which I know it became very famous for, and they brought that back, and then other games brought that back as well. And you know, if people don't know, the kudos system basically rewards you for not only driving fast but sort of driving stylishly. So
yes, drifts and skids,
overtaking,
yeah, exactly, you get rewarded for doing everything.
It was sort of a sweet spot between sort of like Gran Turismo style. Well, I don't know if Gran Turismo is the epitome of gritty realism, but do you know what I mean? Very, very realistic. Because, you know, racing drivers, when they're actually racing today in the vast majority of like motorsports, they're not like swinging the back end down and like drifting and like doing all these dangerous but sexy looking maneuvers. You know, it's all very sort of boring and like, no, we've got to stick to the racing line and we've got to, you know, break into the corner and then accelerate out on this arc. And you don't have to worry about that with MSR, and the sort of the systems they put in place reward you for actually driving a bit more flash.
Yeah, a bit more flamboyantly. Yeah. Wasn't the tagline, it's not about how fast you drive, it's about how you drive fast, which I thought was quite cool.
I didn't know that, but that's spot on.
Yeah. I mean, there are other things in the game which are really like unique to the game. The first one is the music, which was all done by Richard Jacks, who did, I think he did the music for Sonic R and a few other like big Saturn games back in the day. He's, you know, a very talented music producer. He wrote and produced all of the songs in the game and also implemented the sort of the faux radio stations that exist within the world.
Yeah.
For those who are, you know, those eagle-eared listeners, in the DreamPod intro music, the little bit of music towards the end of the intro is taken from MSR's soundtrack. And yeah, the music stations, the radio stations, they had things like real adverts for like real products. You know, when you went under a bridge, you would get the old FM sort of fuzz because, you know, the radio was being interrupted by the bridge. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure this was the first game that had in-game radio stations.
Again, like we're not like super experts on this, but for me, I thought that as well. I hadn't played another game before this that did that and did it in such, again, with that.
Saying in-game as that you can change the channel as you're playing.
Well, it's not just the changing the channel of the music, because you could, like, I mean, even in Outrun, you could select different tracks to play when you race.
You have to select it before you race,
though. Before you race. I think it was those, like, that faux radio station.
Yeah,
that
was the first time, like a DJ introducing songs, and, you know, there'd be, like, adverts in between the songs and stuff like that. And I know that Grand Theft Auto took the baton and ran with it, and, you know, to great effect.
Yeah.
But I think, I'm pretty sure that MSR was the first, if not the first, it was definitely the first racing game that did it anyway. And just to answer your question there, Gaz, you could actually, if you paused it and went to the ICE menu, which is in-car entertainment, which was a nice little touch. You could, this little display of like a car radio would come up and you could like change CDs or you could, you know, put it to a different radio station.
I'm sure you could do that in the Project Gotham games as well.
Yeah, well, I
can't remember.
We'll come on to those very shortly.
Yeah.
Couple of other things I just wanted to mention is like things like, you know, there are 262 tracks in the game, which is a phenomenal amount when you think about it. Obviously, they are made up of, you know, different portions of the cities and some bits will be repeated in different track configurations.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, 262 tracks, you know, was pretty much unheard of back in, you know, the early 2000s. Other things, just the sheer level of customization, you know, you could change like not just the color of your car, but you could change the tint of the windows and what your car's roof would be like when it was raining. You could have a soft top convertible. You could have the roof down. You could have a hard top. You could change a number plate. You could change, you know, message that would come up on your screen when you did a nice maneuver, like a nice skid, or if you hit a wall, you could change all that. There was just so much customization. It was just fantastic. Not only that, it is the sheer variety of events that you could take part in. It's not just straight racing, and it's not just like skill challenges, but you've got things like the hot lap, where your fastest lap would be recorded as your, you know, winning time. You've got overtaking challenges, so you'd get all these drones going around the course and you'd have to overtake as many as you could in the time limit. There's like mini championships.
Yep.
On top of that, as you mentioned earlier, Rob, with the kudos system, you could actually bet on yourself with these things called jokers, where it would actually double the amount of points you got if you were to actually successfully complete the challenge by making it harder for yourself. So like maybe taking the time attack target down by maybe like 3 seconds or something, and if you play the joker, then you also got double points. On top of that, if you didn't pass the challenge, you got double like minus points as well. So there was always that little bit of, you know, extra excitement because you could like bet on yourself. I know games like Speed Devils incorporated betting and things on the races, but not really to this level.
The package you got was phenomenal, actually. I mean, you just listing these things off now, I'd forgotten about some of these things, and it was just an amazingly full-rounded package. And I think it set a benchmark for titles that would come later. I mean, obviously there's Project Gotham, but more, I would say, Need for Speed, like Need for Speed Underground. If you think about those series of games, like all these features, like kudos and betting and the different events, like the hot lap and the street racing, and then longer sort of like one-on-one sort of like duels, you know, like all these things were present in those games. But it was MSR someone could correct me if I'm wrong, but it was MSR certainly on the Dreamcast where it all happened first. And I think you've got a phenomenal package. If you're into racing games, then, you know, you would get so much more mileage out of this than, say, Tokyo Highway Challenge.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the single-player mode is just the amount of challenges and chapters, as they're known, throughout the game. There's so much to do.
There's always something to unlock as well. That was the key, wasn't it? Because you say there was, like, 260-odd tracks, and that's true, but you had to unlock a lot of them.
Yeah, and also the cars as well. I mean, you were teased by what was in the showroom with a sort of a blanket, like a sheet thrown over it, and you could see the outline of it. You're like,
I
wonder what car that is. And then you could, like, you know, challenge for it. And then if you won it, you were like, yes, like punching the air that you got the new car. So, yeah, it was great. And obviously, as with any game, it's not, you know, it's not all rosy in the garden of MSR. There are a couple of issues with it. You know, just on a gameplay level, I find that the brakes are not too good in some of the cars, and you are really encouraged to do as much drifting as you can, really. But then when you take into consideration the kudos system, then that's probably a good thing. Also, there's no damage level models in the game, which, you know, obviously with the limitations of the Dreamcast, probably is for the best. I mean, they might not look that good. Also, the game is notoriously buggy, or rather, there is one version of the game that's notoriously buggy. The story goes that when the game launched in Europe, it had to be recalled because, you know, Sega's quality assurance department had missed a hell of a lot of bugs that were, you know, strewn throughout the game. And so Sega literally had to issue a recall where gamers who had bought the first version of the game could send their copy back and then have a new version, which had all the bugs taken out of it, in the post. I did write an article about this quite a while back on the Dreamcast Junkyard called The Bugs of MSR, where I found the blog. It's basically an MSR blog that was detailing all these bugs. And I emailed the guy saying, look, can I reproduce this on the Junkyard? And he was like, yeah, fine. So here's a brief rundown of some of the bugs that are actually in the first version of the PAL game. I will say that in the US version, all of these have been taken out, so you might not see some of these. But, for example, sometimes a game would corrupt VMUs, and sometimes after a certain amount of time playing the game, all of the Tokyo races would be at night, regardless of what time it was meant to be in Tokyo. If you were trying to use the keyboard to enter your name into the game or doing any kinds of typing, the keys were mapped wrong. So pressing like B would give like A or something like that, you know. In Quick Race, multiplayer Quick Race, the screen would always be blank, so you could never play it. There's one challenge for the Alfa Romeo GTV, which cannot be actually completed because they set the timer too low, that the actual time that you're meant to get. A couple of other things, such as it's always raining when you go under a tunnel, which that's actually present in all of the versions. So the rain never stops. So yeah, there's quite a few bugs. I mean, none of them really are game breaking, apart from some of the ones where you can't get the cars because the target time has been set too low. It's quite interesting that those kind of things like slip through the net. And if you do have the first version of MSR, which has these bugs, I would imagine it's quite sort of rare now because of the recall. And back then people weren't thinking, oh, in 20 years' time, this might be an uncommon version of the game. I'll keep it. They're thinking, I want a proper version of the game that's not got all these stupid bugs in it. I'll send it back to Sega. What Sega did with them at that point, who knows? Maybe just crushed them or burnt them, I don't know. But there must be some still floating around in the wild. I've got two copies of the game, and I think they're both like the later version, because I've looked for some of these bugs, and none of them are in them. So we've talked enough about MSR now, but I just wanted to say that, the game, as Rob rightly mentioned earlier on, the game did go on to become Project Gotham on the Xbox and Xbox 360, which again are some of the best racing games on those platforms by country mile, in my opinion.
Definitely.
Oh, yeah, I love them.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm quite surprised we haven't seen another one. I don't know if the company went bust or something, but we had Project Gotham 4. It'd be a great addition to Xbox One.
I was just going to say, because wasn't Project Gotham Racing a launch title for the Xbox?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, as a launch, I can remember playing. Yeah, I've got my old Xbox somewhere, and that's one of the games that I had. And it's just as a launch game, if you're in any, even if you weren't into your races, it was fabulous. So you know, I haven't played any later ones since then, but that entire series, I think, is pretty damn respected, you know, within the community.
I can remember playing Project Gotham in HMV, which is for those listening who are not in the UK, is a store in the UK, a chain. And just being absolutely like dumbfounded by how good it looked, you know. And also noticing that it had like damage, which obviously is not in MSR, but Project Gotham has full damage models, and it's a great game. So basically what we're trying to say here, and we've been waffling on long enough now, is that if you are a Dreamcast owner and you don't own MSR, you owe it to yourself to go and get it because it's fantastic.
Do it now.
It's cheap.
It's
quite cheap.
Yeah.
Man, I'll have to go check and see if I actually own it or not. I got the whole rack. I have one of those huge towers where you put CDs in it, and that's just kind of there's a lot of random games in there, and I don't know what they are, so I'll have to check that.
Definitely do. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised if you do dig it out and it's in your collection. Oh, one other thing I wanted to mention as well is from reading comments on a couple of YouTube reviews of MSR that I was watching earlier on today. Apparently there was a HMV, again, which is a store in the UK, when the game was launched exclusively in HMV, they had a Metropolis Street Racer watch that they gave away with, you know, the first so many, 100 or something copies of the game. I can't find any information online about this watch. I don't even know what it looks like because there is no other information other than some YouTube comments. So if you're listening to this and you have the HMV Metropolis Street Racer watch, please
send a picture.
Send us a picture, either on the YouTube, on the Facebook page, or on Twitter, or even via email, because I'd love to see what it actually looks like. MSR, fantastic game. If you don't own it, then you owe it to yourself to go and get it.
Okay, yeah, so the next thing we want to talk about is related to the recent Kickstarter campaign for Shenmue 3. There's been a movement recently to get the first two games remade in HD, in high definition. So, yeah, what do we think about this? Is this something that we would like to see in sort of preparation for the third one, which is years away at the moment? Or is this a waste of resources? Should we really just be like, we had it on the Dreamcast? If you don't have it on the Dreamcast, then, well, that's that. And just watch, yeah, just buy the third one or play the third one, which we all know is coming with a sort of catch-up story bit at the beginning, sort of like bringing you up to speed on the story. What do we think?
I think, Rob, what you're talking about here is it Save Shenmue HD movement that's like sort of sprung up on Twitter? Yeah, yeah. My own opinion is that, no, they shouldn't, you know, divert resources to create, you know, updated versions of Shenmue 1 and 2. Well, I mean, what's the point? If they already exist on the Dreamcast. If you really want to play them, go and play them on the Dreamcast, you know. Who is going to make this? I mean, Sega owns the rights. They haven't got the funds to do this.
I'm not a big fan of remakes anyway. This game should be played as they were originally meant to be played. I don't like games being remade for new consoles and things like that. I'm not a big fan of it.
I think I agree with both of you. I think that the originals should played as they are on the original hardware. And that's not being snobby or purist or anything like that at all. It's purely from a practical point of view, not just sort of practical, because you're right, who's going to do this? Sega have very kindly literally donated the image or like the rights to do another Shenmue to Yu Suzuki for. I don't know, they didn't say there was any cost involved. If there was a cost, it was minimal. There was literally nothing he had to pay, so he literally got granted it. But for the original titles, Sega still hold on to those, and everybody knows. I mean, Sega have recovered somewhat over the past 10 years as a software producer, but they don't have the sort of money to just, you know, willy-nilly splash out cash on updating two monstrous games. I mean, I'm not a tech guy myself, but I know enough that it's not just, ah, yes, here we are, Shenmue 1. Well, now feed it into the HD fire machine.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a simple one disc game, was it? For a start, it was multiple discs, and the game itself, you play it for hours and hours and hours and hours.
You know the old phrase, "Give somebody an inch and they'll take a mile."
Yeah,
it's like the whole Save Shenmue brigade, for years and years and years, were going on Save Shenmue, Shenmue 3, da 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 da. Now that's happened.
No, we've got nothing to do.
Right, now what do we do? Oh wait, we've got let's Save Shenmue HD.
Yeah.
Quick. Look, and it's just like, shut up, you man.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's weird because like back in the day, like when a new game out came for a new console. Like, there wasn't, like, nobody was asking for them to re-release this stuff.
Yeah.
Right? Like, even with the Final Fantasy games where they re-released them again and again and again, like, there was never really, like, a backlash from the fans saying, oh, well, Final Fantasy VII is coming out on the PlayStation, like, why isn't all the rest of the games available on the PlayStation at this point? It's weird, because at that point they weren't. They eventually did, because they could make money off of it, but there wasn't like a real fan thing saying, oh, this new game's coming out, therefore I need all the old games on this new console. It didn't seem to really work like that.
Look, I was one of those people, right, for years, you know, I mean, I wasn't running any sort of like social media campaigns, but whenever I spoke to somebody who'd also sort of in the know, oh, you have also played Shenmue, then I was like, oh, yeah, we got it. You know, I would love the third one. It has to happen. I'm praying for it to happen. Why isn't it happening? You know, I want it finished because, you know, it's those games I've got a very, very strong attachment to, and the story and the characters. And it's like having, you know, it's like reading a great novel and having the last 50 pages ripped out, and you know, you've spent 750 pages getting to know the characters and learning this plot, and then suddenly it's not finished. I don't want to offend anybody, but I think there is a little bit of sort of like the internet entitlement culture that's creeping in now.
Yes.
You always hate to use that word, but I would agree with using that word in this particular case.
Yeah, they raised, and I contributed to it, he raised $6.3 million US. That's insane. That is an insane amount of money for, look, again, he's a legend, okay? But he's an old man now, and he was kind of like written off. He was sort of like over the hill. He hadn't done anything really of note for a very long time. And even now, the vast majority of the gaming press are still going, oh, this could go bad.
Because at the end of the day, a game of today's standards, it costs a lot more than $6 million to make. So, at the end of the day, it's not got a huge budget. So
the money here, the $6.3 million, again, there could be someone who's really in the know who'll tell me I'm wrong. But if you want those two HD Shenmues, it's probably this sort of figure, you know, just to turn the two original Shenmues into HD. He's not making Shenmue 3 on $6.3 million US.
Yeah. There's a lot of people saying, obviously, you know, Sony's giving more money into this project, and there's a lot of money that we're not seeing. But it's like those people want to see a return on Shenmue 3 before they're going to do anything else. Like, I mean, that's just how it is.
Ultimately, it's business. You know, we as the end users want to see these games, but ultimately, all these companies are businesses. They want to get a return, a financial gain from the work going into what they're producing. Just going back to what you said there, Rob, about this kind of like entitlement culture. It's like the random people just like, it's like they're just shouting at whoever saying, save Shenmue, but not even thinking about like all of the finance that goes into it and all the planning and the technical side of it. On top of that, I was listening to, I don't know if you guys listen to the Giant Bombcast.
Yes, I do. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. They were talking about the amount of people who actually backed the Shenmue Kickstarter, which was something like 60 something thousand people that raised all this money. I mean, even if 60 odd thousand people bought the game, that is nothing in terms of, you know, sales of, like, when Shenmue 3 eventually comes out, where the rest of the people coming from?
Well, that's not guarantee that this game is going to be successful when it's released.
Yeah, I think the key thing that we need to say here, though, is that the question was, what do we think of the Save Shenmue HD campaign? And I just think that it's pie in the sky, basically. The biggest issue for me is, who is going to make it?
And then who's going to fund it?
I mean, I might have to eat humble pie again. I might be wrong, but you know, it just seems like, you know, again, internet entitlement screaming into the abyss, shouting, "Give us what we want."
Well, that's the thing. They've stopped shouting about Shenmue 3 because it's being made now. They've just got to shout about something else now. It's just boredom, isn't it? So
we all love Shenmue, right? But
Gaz doesn't.
We can. That's the thing.
Well, no, I don't say I love Gaz it. I tried it for a little bit and got bored. So don't get me wrong. Right?
People, or just stories in general, people want stories to have their three acts, you know. It's the classic three act sort of play structure, and everyone wants the final piece. But I think, yeah, people need to just take a step back and just be happy that, you know, this guy who, this will probably be, or could have been his last project, you know, is getting this final chance to put it together, because, you know, I think that's more than anyone could ever have expected.
Well, it doesn't take a lot nowadays with your social media for one person to say something and then a lot of other sheep go yeah, because that's all it is. It's all social media, and people would just jump on the bandwagon for the sake of it, not realizing what they're shouting for.
We're like, you know, we're probably like more creative people than like strict finance guys, like business guys, but I can still appreciate, as Tom said, that business side of things. And as much as I want stories to be told and creativity to be flexed and Yu Suzuki to bring his new vision for, you know, for Shenmue and for this HD project to reimagine Shenmue with these amazing new HD graphics and textures and sounds, you know, maybe they'd have to, you know, want to re-record all the sound as well. Just financially, as you say, like, who's going to make it? And where's the money going to come from? And I think just practically, it's not going
to
happen.
We need to write a letter to Roman Abramovich.
Right.
Now, we always wanted the DreamPod to be a community.
Interactive.
Yeah, interactive. So on social media, we asked for people's questions.
Yeah, we got quite a few.
For the team. Yeah, we got a few. And I think what we're going to do now is we're just going to tackle some of those. So we'll jump straight in and I will read out some of the best. There's a guy called Adam Lundgren. I hope I'm pronouncing Lundgren. His name right.
It's Dolph's brother, isn't it?
Yeah, Dolph's brother, yeah. Yeah.
Dolph's son, I thought.
He actually runs a site called Dreamcast.se, which is Sweden's premier Dreamcast site. So go and check that out. If you can't read Swedish, I can't, you can use Google Translate and everything's there in beautiful English. Not that Swedish isn't beautiful, but I can't read it. But yeah, it's a great site and very well put together. Anyway, Adam asks, Project Justice Rival Schools 2 got a very late release, and I guess it's because that the price is very high. But is it actually any good? I would love to hear your opinions on it. Who's played Rival Schools 2?
I will talk about this real quick. So basically, I'm not a fighting game expert. I know a lot of people really liked the first game on the PlayStation 1, just because it had a lot of really interesting like gameplay variations and stuff like that. And I don't know what those people think of Rival Schools 2 Project Justice. I know I lost out on buying it a number of times when I should have, because it was always expensive. Even in just random shops, like the cheapest I ever saw, it was $20 for just the disc. And that was back in the day when like Dreamcast stuff was being like clearanced out everywhere. So, I didn't get into it until very, very late, but I really always loved the game. There's an interesting system of like team-ups and stuff like that, and it's a very it's a pretty in-depth fighter game. I think a lot of, people that are into fighters would say that the first game actually had a deeper system. But I really enjoy it. It's dumb fun. I mean, it's set in a school, and basically all the characters are teachers or students that are doing the whole Japanese fighting school thing. And the one thing I will say is that the swimmer guy is the most ridiculous character. And by God, I was a champion swimmer in high school. I swam, and I ended up I was top 8. In New York State.
Caleb the Dolphin.
I was top 8 and in high school. Yeah. I was an old school trainer too, and the Japanese swimmer dude is wearing like he's all kitted out with like flippers and stuff. And that's ridiculous. Nobody would like train in that getup. Like that's just it's very insulting to me.
I love that's the one thing that you picked out.
So basically, yeah, so it's a goofy game, but there is some cool, like, little techniques and stuff you can do. Has anybody else heard any feedback about Project Justice?
Yeah, I own it as well, and I do think it's great. One thing that I have, what you just said there, is that it's quite a deep game. I always just thought of it as, like, a really kind of easy to pick up and play game, a bit like Soul Calibur. Because all you have to do, really, is mash a few buttons, and you can pull out the most outrageous moves, especially with your team backing you up as well, obviously with...
Yeah, but I'm talking about like building up the thing and then doing the moves at the right time.
I think it looks great as well. I love the stylized visuals. It's quite cartoony looking, and you've got big chunky sort of low... they're not undetailed, but they're quite low. It's as if they're like 3D cartoons. They've got like low quality textures on them, like almost as if they were in a high-res N64 game. That makes sense.
No, it reminds me more of like a Saturn game, a Saturn 3D fighter,
Rob, you've not played this game, and I just wouldn't... I said to you before, you said you didn't know what it was. What does the name Rival Schools conjure up in your head?
I was just... The first thing that came to mind was Bully. Did anyone play Bully?
No, yeah, that's a great one.
Yeah.
Which was fabulous, but then I thought, no, it's not going to be Rock... It won't have that Rockstar edge. It's just a crazy name, like Project... Justice, Rival Schools, and there was two of them, and like one wasn't enough. And then I thought, well, it wasn't going to be sort of Bully, so I thought it was going to be like Rival Schools, like playing pranks on each other, sort of like when it says Project Justice. I had this idea that it was going to be like children going, oh no, like they egged our our dorm room, so we're going to go and like... We're going to go
or like a top-down real-time strategy game with two schools on different sides of the city, and you've got to like deploy children to like throw stones at different teachers' cars, like Command and Conquer, but with school kids.
Brilliant. With school children, and they've all got like strengths and weaknesses, different stats. Who's good at what? You've got like the big, burly, like tough kids who are like all sort of like brawn and no brains.
And then you've got the nerdy kids who can.
This is actually a better game than Rival Schools 2.
Yeah, and the whole battling schools thing is this weird, like, I don't know if it comes from anime or maybe it's just like kind of a, I don't know, it's some weird thing in Japan. Like, the only cool one that I ever saw was the Crows series, and I don't know if I'm saying this right, but there's a couple movies and there was a game on the Saturn too, which is super expensive. I haven't found a legit copy of it yet, but in that game it's awesome because it's basically two schools just absolutely... You know, a bunch of teenagers just beating the absolute crap out of each other.
Oh, it is with Japan. They love like kids fighting each other. I mean, Battle Royale.
The Crows is kind of like Battle Royale, except like they don't have any weapons. They're just martial arts fighting each other, but it's super brutal.
I think you'd like the Hunger Games, guys.
Oh no, I've seen the Hunger Games.
Oh
Hunger,
yeah, PG-13.
Hunger Games
have
got nothing on Battle Royale. Battle Royale is brutal.
PG-13. Yeah, what was the joke that somebody was saying? Like, Hunger Games is Battle Royale with cheese. That's what it is.
Nice. Adam did ask quite a few questions. I'll just whiz through a couple of others that he asked. Which game is the most anticipated indie game under development right now? There's quite a few that I find quite interesting. You've got Elysian Shadows. You've got The Ghost Blade.
You've got Ducks,
Redux 2, yeah. You've got Amoeba from Regisumus.
Pure Solar. I'm still waiting for my Pure Solar game to be shipped to me from the Kickstarter. I've been holding off on playing the PC release because I want to play that game fresh on the Dreamcast when it comes out.
Keep holding on. It's coming. And one other from Adam is, if the Dreamcast was super successful, do you think the indie scene would still exist? I think it'd be even bigger, to be honest.
It was successful. I guess how you would judge it. Like, I guess it was not a long-term success, but man, it's like everybody in the U.S. knew what the Dreamcast was, and a lot of people bought them. If you look at the numbers, I mean, it's really just how you gauge success. I mean, I certainly think that, if you go to any, like... In certain areas of the United States, Dreamcast was super popular, and a lot of people know what's up with that. I think if it was even more successful, I think the indie scene would be bigger just because, like, I think the indie scene basically spawned out of the fact that it's just so easy to get around the security of the Dreamcast versus other consoles, you know?
It was an ideal console to make indie games on.
Yeah, I don't think the successfulness, is that a word, of the console
it is now.
Actually had any bearing on the fact that it's such an open platform to make games for, so... I think it probably would have been even bigger. Yeah. Sorry, Rob, are you going to say something?
You've literally just paraphrased what I was going to say. I agree with you entirely, Tom. I think that's spot on.
One more question from Adam. So this is quite long-winded, but I'll make it brief as I can. Collecting Dreamcast games is expensive and takes time, sometimes years. Is it better from a financial point of view to buy the cheaper games now or the more expensive? I think what he means is all games will probably get higher in price in time.
Right.
So which is better, getting the cheaper games now or the hard to find games now?
Well, they're only going to go up in price. So if you're going to collect and you've got the money, get the expensive games while you can.
I kind of agree with you guys there. But what I would say is I don't think this question is phrased like correctly at all. Like collectors and collecting is something I've thought quite a bit about, you know, because the retro scene is let's all be honest, we all know it's insane sometimes. Like, it's so sort of like you've got to have so much knowledge, you've got to be so much in the know, you know, there's so many price fluctuations. You cannot dip your little toe into the retro collecting market right now and expect to come away like...
I know someone who has a full PAL set Dreamcast. In terms of collecting, it's one of the easiest ones to get a full set on, the Dreamcast. The games are all out there. There's nothing super, super rare. There are a few expensive ones, like your Taxi 2.
Moho is another one.
Moho, they allude. Evolution 2, there's another one. But in terms of collecting, they are
quite obtainable.
Right. I think it's one of the most, you know, it is a very collectible platform. I totally agree with you. But what I would say is my point is, ask yourself, why are you collecting? Like, you say, like, what games should I buy? Buy games that you like playing.
Well, that's exactly what I said before. I mean, I've pretty much listed my whole collection for sale because I'm sick of having games I don't play.
I agree with you guys. I mean, I think that's an incredibly healthy attitude to have towards collecting. Collect what you like in terms of playing, not what you think you should buy or what some hipster or what some website or what some, you know, what somebody's telling you should buy. Like, you don't have to buy every game on the Dreamcast. I mean, you can do if you want to.
Well, that's it. I mean, I mean, collecting is some people will want to collect the full sets. I know one guy who has full sets of pretty much everything, and he loves collecting. And then other people just buy games that because they're cheap and they just go nonsense like I did.
Yeah.
Just buy everything you can because it's cheap, and then now I've got bored of it, so I'm selling it all. And then others will just collect for a particular series, which is what I'm doing now.
Yeah, yeah. What about Rob? What about hipster websites like the Dreamcast Junkyard? What about if they tell you to collect everything?
Well, yeah, you should obey.
Yeah, we can make an exception for the yard. We're sort of like alpha hipster. We're like hipster hipsters. Yeah, we're like one layer, another layer removed in terms of hipster factor, so we can get away with it.
I think we all need to start. We all need to grow beards, basically.
Beards, flat caps, beards. Yeah, maybe some dungarees. Maybe we can all wear dungarees. Bring them back.
Yeah, nice pipe.
Yeah,
and we'll all move to Shoreditch.
The Dreamcast Junkyard, yeah, it's now based in Shoreditch Central, yeah.
All right.
No, I'm... look, I don't want to sound like I'm wailing on anyone. Like, Gaz is right, like, if you want to collect, like, collecting can be a hobby, you know, and if you want the full PAL set, then Gaz is right. The Dreamcast is one of the most easy consoles for you to do that in terms of getting a full library. It's a nice thing. The library isn't too big. It's not too small. Prices... For most things, let's say 90% of things,
they're relatively cheap. Yeah, you can pick them up quite easily.
Yeah, well, I would say too. Unfortunately, if you're gonna do it on the cheap like me, so as the person who actually does have a beard and hipster glasses right now, I'd like to weigh in. So if you're looking for something that's easy to collect in America, then I would actually go with like the Genesis or something like that, because you can find good quality stuff. Dreamcast games, unfortunately, in the U.S., if you're going to collect them on the cheap, the cases are going to be cracked, they're going to look like crap, and unless you're going to be doing, like, CD wallets or have some way of organizing the actual discs, it's actually not going to be cheap to get something that's worth collecting. Now, my quote-unquote collection is just a pile of, you know, electric tape cases and just stuff that's just random crap that I got for cheap. If I was smart during the day when the Dreamcast stuff was being clearanced out of stores that, by the way, no longer exist anymore because the physical media has taken a nosedive, then I could have gotten a really good collection. Unfortunately, I didn't have the money back then. And the thing you have to know is that if you're going to do a collection, you really got to, you know, keep it in your mind that this stuff costs money. If you're at a young age, you're better off spending that money on other stuff mostly. And you really, you know, just look for value, but, you know, don't go crazy, unfortunately. Which, you know, I might have gone crazy a little bit because I own a lot of stuff that I bought just because it was cheap, and most of it, if I didn't have access to a resurfacer that's like, you know, I have access to like a really quality disc resurfacer at my work, and I can buff out most discs and stuff like that. A lot of people don't have that, and Dreamcast is, you know, GD-ROM based system. So a lot of the stuff you're going to get, unfortunately, discs are going to skip if they're not in the best condition. So honestly, I would not suggest that Dreamcast is actually a good console to collect if you're interested in a collection. Probably Genesis would be the one I would suggest, because there's a lot of great games on there, and collecting them is a lot easier.
You mentioned, obviously, the cases. The PAL cases are notoriously crap.
Yeah.
They're awful.
Oh, yeah, and talk about collecting and stuff real quick. I just want to throw this in here, too. GameStop, I still have not talked to anybody who has gotten any of the games off that website. I'd like to know what quality the cases and stuff are from there. I don't know if it's leftovers or they're getting them from another retailer. Yeah, if you mention on the Facebook, if you've done any collecting via the GameStop retro Dreamcast type thing that they're doing online now, and let me know, because that's interesting. And boy, it's just, and again, the thing about eBay is you cannot get a decent picture of a disc surface to know how beat up a disc actually is or not.
Okay, let's move on. Next, we've got a question from Elliot Cardiff, who asks, considering all the accessories made for the Dreamcast by Sega and third parties, which do you feel are worth getting and which can or should be ignored? My own personal experience, I would say if you can get them cheap, definitely get the official steering wheel, which came out in the US as the rally wheel. Also get the official arcade stick. Those are two peripherals that I use quite a lot. One thing I would say to avoid, personally, is third-party controllers. I mean, official controllers are so cheap now, you can pick them up. They're the best quality, they've got the best analog sticks, they're the right size. Some of the Mad Catz ones and up from other manufacturers are absolutely massive, and the analog sticks are crap, and the triggers are just rubbish. So if you can, get the official controllers, not third-party ones. Guys, I don't know about you, what do you suggest?
The official section offered by Sega, some of which are outsourced, like the arcade stick is outsourced to a third party, but it's technically an official product,
mm-hmm.
was quality. Like the actual quality of the product was super high, and the scope and range of the accessories was also really, really good. So I've never personally had recourse to get any third party peripheral.
Yeah.
The Mad Catz light gun was the quote-unquote official light gun release in the U.S. because Sega didn't actually release one. So the Mad Catz light gun is pretty good. It's a solid piece of stuff. But, you know, I have to say, like, the Dreamcast arcade pad is just so good. It's probably the best accessory for the Dreamcast, that I would say.
Yeah.
And honestly, if you're going to do like a collection and you're going to be messing around with a lot of first-person Dreamcast games, then the mouse and keyboard are also something you can find for a halfway decent price.
Yeah,
that they're pretty well-made stuff. Boy, as for games and stuff and that you need like special stuff for, it's like it's really up to you. I mean, I do tournaments and stuff at the local library, so I'm well within my rights to own two versions of Samba de Amigo. But I think most collectors don't need that.
Yeah. There is on that note exactly. There is a third party maracas set for the Dreamcast. I can't remember the name of it for the life of me, but it's basically not.
I got weird blue one. Like, I thought it was the official UK one in the eBay lot, because I bought, like, an official one. There's this weird blue one, too. And it was called Maracas Friends. And it wasn't the one, because you're talking about the one that was on the Japanese import site, I believe. Those, I think, were good. This is this weird blue one. It's called Maraca Friends. And it's got the weird thing where it's, like, it's got the off artwork and stuff. And those are not very good. I forget the name of the ones that are from the Japanese import sites, but those are pretty decent as well.
Oh, but I'd heard the opposite. I'd heard that they were really bad. The unofficial.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Dreamcast Maracas. So yeah, I would say personally.
Oh well, never mind then. I heard from one person that they were good, but if you heard that they were bad, then I would probably trust you more than anything.
Yeah, okay. The next question is from David Heaton, and he says, I was flicking through some old promo pamphlets in the PAL releases and spotted a coming soon listing for Jet Set Radio 2. We all know this never happened on the Dreamcast, but were there any other flagship sequels you know of that never saw the light of day? First ones that came to mind for me were Hydro Thunder 2, which was mentioned in the Sega Bits podcast, which was on the site a couple of weeks ago, and also Arctic Thunder, which was another game in the Midway Thunder series, you know, with Hydro Thunder and Four Wheel Thunder. Arctic Thunder was a snowmobile game, which was at one point announced for the Dreamcast, but then just like kind of faded into the mists of time, and we never saw it. The other ones that came to mind were Soul Reaver 2, which did see the light of day on the PlayStation 2. And last but not least, Tony Hawk 3, which was started for the Dreamcast, but then never came out. I mean, it would have been quite late if it had come out. I believe it was that was the last ever game for the N64 as well, so that just shows you how late in the day it was coming. But yeah, Tony Hawk 3 is another one. I don't know about you guys. Have you got any others on the tip of your tongues?
Wasn't there, I keep on thinking about the Castlevania game, but I don't know if that was going to be very good or not.
Oh, the Konami Castlevania 3D game.
Yeah. I mean, it was so early that there was no telling, like, if it was going to be decent or not. But I was very interested in that.
What was that called? Castlevania...
Is it Resurrection?
Oh, yeah, Resurrection, you're right. Castlevania Resurrection.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff online, but I mean, all of those images are basically taken from, like, they're not running on Dreamcast hardware. They're all running on, like, dev kit and things. They're not actual screenshots. But it looks interesting. Yeah, I mean, I would have liked to have seen it, come
and,
out.
And the thing that did, that eventually, the Dreamcast Half-Life version that eventually got turned into Half-Life Blue Shift for the PC. I thought that would be super awesome if that was released on the Dreamcast, because Blue Shift was actually a nice little single-player campaign, and that would have been awesome to have an official release on that.
Yeah, that's the one where you play as Barney the security guard. If I'm not
mistaken. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
The version of Half-Life I've got actually includes that game, so you can actually play it on the Dreamcast. It's pretty good.
Yep.
Okay, moving on.
Again, shout out to Father K. He got me my copy of that.
Indeed, shout out to Father K, who may be returning to the junkyard in a few weeks or months, but you know, we'll announce that close to the time. Ross O'Reilly asks, Sonic Shuffle or a slap in the face?
Slap in the face.
Oh yeah, but then he goes on to mention, which is bang out of order, he said, who would win in a fight, the Dreamcast or the Jaguar?
Okay.
I'm going to go for Jaguar every time, I'm afraid. 64-bit interactive multimedia system.
All right, so if you'll allow me to answer this question, because I put a lot of thought into this.
Okay, please.
The controllers for the Dreamcast and the Jaguar would cancel each other out due to the robust nature of both of them.
Okay.
Now, however, the Dreamcast would have an advantage because it would be able to open up its mouth and literally, like, bite the Jaguar to death. Now you can say, now I can hear your comeback right now, and I'll tell you, if the Jaguar had its CD attachment, then it's most likely it would fail immediately, and the result would still be the same of the Dreamcast taking out the Jaguar console easily.
That's it. That's impeccable logic.
Yeah. No, all joking aside, yeah, the Dreamcast is, you know, light years ahead of the Jag. It's only weirdos like me who like to collect for the Jag who have, you know, anything good to say about the thing. Rob came to my house a few weeks ago, and
I showed him
the delights of a game called Club Drive, and the very large polygonal cat that basically slides around the carpet.
You say cat. That's been really generous. Like can I visually describe it? It's like a cube, like a rectangular cube. I don't know what the proper term for that is. It's like a rectangular cube with another cube for the head, and then like this bit stuck out the end, and it was a bright orange, and it literally like just slides around the floor. There's no legs. It's just sort of like weirdly like.
Listen. Rob, that is a artistic choice that the people made for the Jaguar, and you know, you shouldn't really be judging them because it was a choice they made.
It's exactly that. It was the aesthetic that they chose to represent the cat in a 3D environment through the medium of a sliding block. So you know,
yeah, that must be it.
No, I was going to say for those people who are listening to this now, if you go onto YouTube and type Club Drive Cat, you'll find a video of it and you'll see exactly what we're talking about. Sorry, go ahead, Rob.
I was going to say that I wouldn't be surprised if sooner or later the Tate Modern had it sort of like had like a Club Drive exhibit. And it was just like a bunch of like cuboid shapes sliding around a floor. That's pretty much it. That's pretty much Club Drive, right there.
Okay, the next question is from Chris Diebel, who asks, what are your favourite Dreamcast colour variants? His favourite is the silver console. I'll just go first. Mine is the blue Gundam one with the red buttons and the sort of yellow bit in the middle. But I do like the Sega Sports black one as well. Guys, I don't know which is yours.
I'll just say it's my favourite, but I do want the Resident Evil Japanese console, obviously, for my Resident Evil collection. I do quite like that one.
Cool. What about you, Rob?
I like the Sega Sports black one, and I don't know if I should admit this, but I also like the Hello Kitty one.
I knew you were going to say that.
It's just, there's something about that Hello Kitty console.
It's a great console. I like the look of the Divers Edition, just because it's got that real retro weird look.
Oh, yeah, with
the spikes on top and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But from my own collection, I got this really cool translucent, like kind of smoky black controller, which is cool looking. I like that.
Oh, nice. Next, we'll just whiz through these. We've got Harpreet Atwell asks, Under Defeat or Zero Gunner? I'm going to say Under Defeat, because I think that's a brilliant game.
I second that.
Yeah, me too.
Under Defeat.
Yep, that's
it's
unanimous.
4-0. It's a 4-0 to Under Defeat.
Unanimous decision.
And last but not least, Martin K, who is on the Facebook page as Dreamcast Martin K, so we all know which console he likes. he asked, what game would you have liked to have seen made for the Dreamcast? Straight away, my first one would have been one of the International Superstar Soccer games from Konami, ISS Pro Evo.
I would have loved to have seen an addition to the Shining series from the Mega Drive to the Saturn.
Well, the Shining Force games?
Yeah, I would have loved to have seen them on the Dreamcast.
Caleb?
Boy, I don't know. It's just, there's a lot of really good stuff on there. I don't know. I'd have to think about it. I automatically want to say like something like survival horror, but there was already like a ton of them on there.
Yeah. Oh, no worries. And Rob?
I think I've said it before, but I would love to have seen the voxel glory of Outcast on the Dreamcast. I think this. I genuinely think that could have been a game that, you know, really sold people on the Dreamcast. Maybe I was wrong because sales figures on the PC were poor, but I don't know. I would love to have seen that come out on the Dreamcast.
Yeah, we did speak about that very in depth, didn't we? Episodes ago. Yeah, yeah. That was a very good game that was announced, but then sadly never saw the light of day. Thank you to all our listeners for sending these questions in. I hope the answers have been satisfactory. If not, then please send your complaints to Gaz. What's your email address?
It's lostruin@googlemail.com. Yeah. And they will be filed in the bin section.
In the bin section, was that?
Yeah.
So, yeah, thanks. Thanks you very much for listening. That is pretty much going to be the end of the podcast. Once again, I'd like to thank you, Rob. You're on Twitter at
r_Nicholas_J.
And Gaz, you're on Twitter at
lostruin, all one word.
And Caleb, you're on Twitter, but yeah.
I am on Twitter.
Yeah. That's a game. You can find him and you can tweet to him. I'm also on Twitter. I'm at Tom Leesey. The Junkyard is on Twitter, at Sega Junkyard. And we're on Facebook at facebook.com, The Dreamcast Junkyard. And we've got the main site as well, which is, funnily enough, www.thedreamcastjunkyard.co.uk. And if you're listening to this and you like what you hear, please go onto Google.
Vote.
Yeah, type in UK Podcast Awards and you'll find the site. It's New Media Europe's UK Podcast Awards. And in the video game section, you'll find the Dreamcast Junkyard along with Retro Asylum and UK PlayStation Radio. If you like us, give us a vote. And
if you don't, vote anyway.
Yeah. All it remains for me to say is thanks for listening and we'll see you on the next episode of DreamPod.
Bye. Bye, folks.
Bye.
Please stop this disc now.